Hello and good morning, folks. 6 o'clock on Monday, the 7th of November. This is The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sherrod Kutin and Julian Ng here with me too. Good morning, guys. Happy Monday.
Good morning.
Happy Monday.
Has
anybody ever said that to you in real life?
Positive people. I'm trying to start off on a good note.
Do people actually say Happy Monday?
Well, if you are looking forward to the week, you know,
I've heard Thank God it's Friday. I've never heard Happy Monday.
Thank God it's Monday. Has anyone ever said that in the history of mankind?
I don't think so.
I think that would be payday.
How was your weekend? Good weekend?
Good, good.
Yeah, it was eventful. I actually moderated a talk for the British High Commission on Saturday around the really big issue of culture and identity. So
that's deep, man.
It was. I mean, and I think it was partly driven by the panelists, Yana Rizal, Punky Tech, Edin Koo, and so. Now, they drove the conversation deep into gravitas.
Very nice.
Very serious stuff.
Are you going to have another deep conversation today on The Breakfast Grill? Because you'll be speaking to Dr. Martin Jacques, the author of When China Rules the World, today on The Grill.
Yeah. And so that conversation, I mean, coming across on the back of the Prime Minister's visit to China, which I think he took a third of his cabinet with him. The kind of superlatives that came out of it, you know, the 155 billion ringgit deals, worth of deals that came out.
Was that 144 or 155?
I thought it was 155. It was maybe 144. Yeah. Okay.
I think it's 144.
So
it's all right. It's just about 11 billion.
It's 9 billion.
It's nothing.
You haven't been different. But, you know, it all adds up to pretty much the kind of numbers that you see for China around the world. What we talked about was, you know, coming now, 7 years after he wrote the book, When China Rules the World, we talked about precisely what kind of things might derail China's plans or this trajectory, and a range of other issues, I think, that continue to concern observers, you know, especially as he sees the Western observers, which he thinks often get it wrong.
Well, you know, I was looking at the papers and media sites over the weekend, and there was a slew of op-eds about Najib's visit to China, Malaysia's closer ties to China now, and a lot of people are expressing concern everywhere, from Malay Mail Online, Malaysia Kini, to The Edge Weekly, and even other NST op-eds as well. So you could see that clearly there's some concern here.
Yeah, I think that FDIs on the face of it is not a bad thing. People should welcome that kind of thing. And whether it's from China or elsewhere, I guess to use a word from Ong Kah Chuan, right? People should be colorblind about this kind of deals. But the thing is that there's so many questions unanswered about the cost of these projects. For example, the East Coast Railway being priced at 55 billion. Nobody knows how that is priced and who are what is the local benefit to this, whether China is going to use their ecosystem to just export back to themselves. Those are some of the questions. And even to the extent of some of the how it would affects the Bumiputra policy, for example. And now that the Chinese are here, right, and there are ethnic Chinese in Malaysia as well, and other races in Malaysia, whether they will still be subject to that kind of Bumiputra policy.
Yeah, I think the nationalist agenda, we saw, of course, with the TPP, you know, a whole range of carve-outs, right? Malaysia got exemptions from, in order to fulfill its own domestic agenda. The question is, with the deals being brokered with these Chinese entities, whether you will have the same capacity to negotiate the domestic agenda. I mean, some people might say this is a good thing. And in fact, I think over the TPP, a lot of free trade advocates were upset with the carve-outs because in some ways the TPP lost its bite to be a game changer for what, you know, some people are calling a fairly moribund economy. The question is, with China, do we again see the possibility of a game changer? That and along with all the other strategic issues, right, the concerns about Malaysia's pivot to China, the buying of the naval vessels. Again, we know it's 4 vessels, but we don't know how much they cost, and so on and so forth. And how do we fit in with this, you know, China's One Belt, One Road and Maritime Silk Road policies, right? So, yeah, lots of questions being asked. But I think Martin Jakes' own position is that China, much more than the West, understands the developmental aspirations of all these countries, Malaysia included. And therefore, you know, it would be as good a partner, in some instances, perhaps a better partner than Western entities, the Western nations and entities.
Well, I look forward to that discussion on The Breakfast Grill, Dr. Martin Jakes, author of When China Rules the World. And after The Grill at 8:35 a.m., we try to define what offensive speech means for Malaysia. Because under Malaysian legislation, speech that offends the religious feelings or sensibilities of others can be penalised. So on Current Affairs, we try to explore the laws surrounding offensive speech as well as its appearance on social media. So offensive speech, does that translate equally into hate speech to you, Sherrod?
Well, not necessarily.
Is it the same as offensive and hate speech?
Well, okay, so you, I mean, the words are there. I mean, offensive or hate or whatever it is. The question is what should be criminalised and what should be allowed as part of, you know, I mean, if I was an advocate of free speech, I would hesitate to censor, right? I mean,
so
I
you
don't
would defend the right to be offensive.
To be offensive, for sure. I mean, it's a thin line, right? I mean, I think this is a cultural thing, not just a legalistic question. So the laws help us negotiate the much more difficult territory of how people are culturally, like, you know, people take offense.
Yeah.
You know, and people are so quick to take offense.
And how people take offense can vary from one person to the next, right, Jules? What do you think? How would you define offensive speech? It's such a tricky subject.
Yeah, actually, I don't want to be in a position where the government takes a stance in deciding what is and what isn't offensive speech. But I know about the cultural aspect of it, and we have a history of racial riot, what is believed to be a racial riot, and therefore something has to be done about this along the lines of how Germany bans fascist activities and fascist speeches.
Yeah, you can't do the Sieg Heil and this kind of thing, like the Nazi salute.
The thing is that I'm more supportive of education, right? A society that respects free speech and gives you the right to ignore the kind of speeches that are so-called offensive and just not either ignore,
not react, right?
Yeah, not react, ignore them, or defend them in a certain way, or answer, give an answer to those kind of speeches in a certain way.
I mean, look at, you know, it's not just a race issue. I mean, when, you know, that movie Pekak came out,
I had not watched that. Yeah, have you watched it?
No, I haven't watched it, but I read the controversy around it. It went to Brunei, got banned in Brunei. But you see it, if you know, it's advertised constantly on television here.
What is the controversy around it?
Well, because the protagonist, or one of the two main characters, is hearing impaired, but he also is a drug dealer. And there's a lot of freewheeling liberal activity going on. And so the community, or some representatives of the community, or self-proclaimed of the hearing impaired community, came out and said, how can you do this? We're offended.
It shows in a bad light.
Yeah, you know, finally you have a character with hearing impairment, and you make him a drug dealer. And this happens over and over again, with people taking offense, you know, wanting to see in characters like this, you know, representatives. Why should this character be a representative of anything except his own individuality? The fact that he happens to be hearing impaired is just by the by. I mean, it drives the plot,
right.
But you know, it is interesting. Well, hearing impaired people are naturally inclined to criminality, especially of the drug version. I mean, nothing is like that is asserted in the movie. It merely is, right? But you know, so there you have this community kind of up in arms, and you know,
exactly. And I think this kind of laws are very negative, for want of a better word, right? You should make positive law. Now, the government has a right to eliminate violence, reduce crime, or the government can promote, let's say, education. That's a positive step yeah. rather than...
It's more affirmative than negative.
Exactly.
But it's harder to prove, though, with going positive, right? I guess it's... You're talking like prevention is better than cure type of method, right?
So no, you prevent racism. That is a byproduct. The prevention part is byproduct. But if you make good educational policies, for example, you know, while prevention of stupidity is a byproduct of that. No,
I think you're being overly optimistic. I mean, I think even a great education system will not stop people from being bigoted and prejudiced. I mean, you might lower the thing and you might make it a little more nuanced, but I mean, people, there are multiple motives for why people are racist.
Offensive speech laws are not the answer to that. I mean, how do these laws compare to like making education?
I just think we have to accept that the
better.
People are going to be offensive regardless, yeah, right?
Exactly. So why legislate against it, right?
Absolutely.
It's so subjective.
I agree.
A fertile topic for discussion, one we will be exploring on Current Affairs, 8:35 a.m. And later on the show, on Pressing Matters at 9:35, we have Joyce Goh from the Edge Media Group to get behind recent headlines. Today, we look at Star Media's plan to launch an OTT service that's over-the-top content, providing Asian content. Over-the-top content doesn't mean exaggerated content. It simply means content from TV and film delivered via the internet.
Well, the traditional providers may actually go OTT on hearing the new competition.
So really quite interesting, because their move into this space is one that is... going to be filled with challenges. There's already many players in the space. Netflix, iFlix, Media Prima's got their own OTT service. Astro's got their On The Go and Enjoy. So why would Star attempt to try to take a slice off this pie? We'll find out more from Joyce Goh from The Edge Media on Pressing Matters, 9:35. 12 minutes past 6. Let's take a quick look at the news. Coming up in the week ahead, of course, I think the US presidential elections is set to dominate headlines over the coming week. We've got concerns of poor voter turnout in the US, especially millennials, given that millennials make up about 31% of eligible voters in the US. So this could be a concern if millennials decide not to turn up.
Yep, I think the poor showing or the low showing by the millennials would be to Donald Trump's advantage, because a lot of them would probably be anti-Donald Trump and not necessarily pro-Hillary Clinton, right?
Well, I think millennials is a huge category, because it crosses ethnic demographics, it crosses, class demographics as well. So I don't know what exactly a millennial is. I mean,
well,
working class millennial.
It's the first-time voters, which is interesting. Because,
young voters,
young voters could also, you could be a working class young voter, you could be a college educated young voter. We know, of course, that Hillary is doing very well. For the first time, the Democrats have captured the majority of white college educated demographic. That's the first time since polling began in the 50s, right? But what you do see is, in fact, this huge Latino surge, and that's in the news as well. Mm-hmm. So the Latino surge in states like Nevada look to push Hillary to win, take that state. There's a huge Latino surge in Florida as well.
Well, she had a very good campaign manager for the Hispanics. Donald Trump. Donald Trump was great in pushing the votes towards Hillary.
The other thing is actually there's a ground strategy for the Democrats. It's always the thing, how many people can you make turn out? And apparently the polls, I mean, according to some analysis, the polls did not capture this Latino surge, and they didn't capture the sentiments of the Latino community.
So when can we expect the results to come in for us here in Malaysia? I think
Wednesday midday.
So the US votes... Tuesday, and because they're about 12 hours. Oh, let me just reiterate, daylight savings time has come to an end in the US, so they're 11 hours now. Right now, I believe it's 5:14 in the US, certain parts of the US. So we should see some results trickle in early Wednesday morning, leading up to the afternoon.
So, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to keep
and
your
breath. And I think a last minute help for a little nudge for Hillary. Hillary Clinton is that the FBI said that there's no new evidence against her, no reason to investigate or arrest her further.
I wonder whether these statements do make a change so close to the elections.
But it shouldn't be. I mean, it might not, because a lot of people vote early and they already have results for some areas in Nevada, like Clark County, apparently, that covers most of Kansas. I was speaking to based in America, is an academic, and he was telling me that, you know, most of these cities, you have to take it in terms of these the structure of American states, right? And most of the votes are coming from the urban centers, and in something like Clark County, or they've already mostly voted. Over 470,000 people have voted.
Early voting.
You know, and you can already tell where that's going. And that's why they can almost call Nevada for Hillary at this point in time.
6:15 now. We'll be back with more in just a few minutes on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. That was Could You Be Loved by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Some reggae for you in the morning. 6:21 right now. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sherrod Kutten and Julian Ng here with me. Now, we've come across this story about Maurice Villarroel. He is a life logger. What makes him special is that for the last 6 years, he has been recording his life in minute detail using a logbook, a camera, and a fitness tracker. We're talking about 1,200 photos every day, because he's got one of these little cameras attached to his chest that take photos every 30 seconds. I don't know that you've seen it. Looks like a pin, like a little.
I think it came out a few years ago.
Exactly. Right. I can't remember this. Jeff Sandu from Tech Talk or Uma Pagan, who tried out this feature in the office and annoyed everyone in the office because they were taking random shots of people with really bad expressions.
So this is really the consequence of, you know, technology in some ways, right? The ability to document at this kind of level. But then people have been documenting their lives and their thoughts for at least 1,000 years.
But I mean, not to this minute detail, second.
Yeah, so the question is, what do you gain from having 1,200 photographs a day? And I think, you know, I think back to, you know, well, St. Augustine wrote his Confessions, you know,
many years ago.
And I know some, you know, I know people. My mother is a great documentarist of her own life, or the recently deceased Ted Miles, you know, who, and I remember when I visited him once, you know, he had all the movies he ever watched, right? There was a kind of a period of a decade where he documented every movie he watched and his thoughts on it.
Yeah.
And I think that this, people have been doing this, but it's a question of the quality of that, of those observations of your own life that really matter. You know, yeah. Marcel Proust, you know, Swan's Way. I mean, these are all about documenting your own self. I mean, you know.
Okay, so this guy, Mr. Villarreal, he said that this move to become a life logger occurred shortly after he turned 40. He was looking back on his life and was wondering, what did he have to show for it? So he decided, well, record everything then. And I really wonder if that's the way to have a meaningful life. If you look back, what did I do November 4th, 2007. Do you want to know? I mean, what's the point of it? I don't think that's the way to go about living a meaningful life.
Yeah, but you know, it's technology allows this kind of thing to work in the background so that you don't have to have a lot of intervention in what happens with the recording.
It's that Facebook timeline thing, isn't it?
Facebook timeline or even Google Photos. I'm on Google Photos now, actually, because I try to snap a few pictures a day as a way to journalize my life or my day. And then Google Photos, the app on my phone, automatically uploads it into the cloud. And I think that Sherrod is right in a way, because in the past, you have some observation and insight into your life. And I read Ted Miles's articles before, and his memoirs, right, when he put it into the newspapers at the time, and was really entertaining, and he had his own thought about it. But for a person who's just using technology to video your surroundings, right, what insights can you get out of it? The one thing that I find that could be at least providing some kind of value added or insight is that of GPS, right? Now the technology can know where you are and can tag that to a certain location.
So you can always track where you've been?
And on top of that, having some kind of face recognition, right? And so the computer can tell you, oh, you were here and we are tracing your journey and you interacted with these people,
whoa,
which the computer knows through face recognition. And that's the only value added. But it says nothing about what your thoughts and observations
right.
were at the time.
And what you felt at that time. Just a quick note. I have to say, a lot of people have told me that journaling is really good for the soul. So every day, keep a journal of what you've done, what you're thinking about. When I was in sabbatical, I tried that. I got to day 3 and then you can see the rest of the journal is empty.
Interesting. Why did you lose interest?
I'm
interested
tired.
To know that. You got tired.
For one thing, I wrote, the first day was damn semangat lah. So I wrote like 5 pages on the first day. Then my hand got tired. The fingers crammed really. And then the second day, it got shorter. And then the third day, I think I did halfway. Then I got distracted by a movie that was showing on TV and never came back to it.
Well, you
Were you not appealed by online journalizing? Did you think that you had to write it down?
Yes, I thought I had to write it down because I bought a book and then I had it inscribed. Sabbatical 2016.
Yeah. I mean,
all 5 days of it.
Yeah. I mean, if you distinguish the medium in which you write and all that, all of which has, I think, a particularly kind of an aesthetic value, right? I mean, fountain pen and all that. But, you know, Socrates said, and he's got that famous dictum, right? You
Socrates,
here we go.
People
from the past.
No, the
thank God they recorded their thoughts. Otherwise, Sherrod would not have known about it.
Or have anything to say. Yeah. The unexamined life is not worth living, you know. And look, so this, the issue really is not just, I mean, capturing it in, you know, full color. I think it's distilling it, putting a frame on it, drawing out meaning and a deeper insight. And this is what, you know, people have been doing for the longest time, you know, I mean, in literary form, you know, in terms of philosophy. So, you know, I look at this, I think, okay, so there's an extraordinary capacity to capture everything. But the real work begins when you pare it down, when you distill, when you crystallize your thoughts and you draw out the significance. That's the real work. It's not taking 1,200 pictures a day.
Well, I mean, apparently, this man, this life logger, tags his work. So his data entries, his logbooks, his photos, he tags them so he can go back and refer to them. I have a question. Do you think that if you were to become a life logger, you would miss out on the moments because you're so busy logging. You're so busy taking photos
and writing.
Well, you don't
have to be busy logging.
But you don't, and you don't appreciate the moment. So this man took photos of when his father died or when his granddaughter was born. I mean, so you're not there. You're not present in the moment to appreciate your granddaughter being born because you're so busy taking pictures and writing in your
day-to-day
book.
But, you know, photographers, you could say this of any, say, photographer, right? I mean, yes, in some sense, they are at a distance from the action because they're holding a camera. It's, you know, their experience is in part mediated by the lens, right? But I think that's not entirely true. I mean, they're also there. It's just that they, you know, kind of have a particular interest in capturing that moment. And so I think you can't accuse, say, I wouldn't accuse a photographer of having no involvement, attachment to the moment.
This is the age of the handphone, right? Everyone is a photographer. And if you allow yourself to go crazy, you'll be snapping photos all the time. And I agree, it does take away, like music concerts, for example, right? Everybody is videoing something that they can, at the end of the day, find on somewhere on the internet anyway, right? So why do it? Why not just enjoy the moment?
You paid for that ticket.
Listen to the music that's going on and leave it to memory to allow you to remember the day.
So coming back to journaling, why did you guys ask me if I considered online journaling? Is that something you would do?
I have done it, actually.
Oh, you do? Okay.
And I fell prey to laziness as well after that. same thing.
Same affliction we have. Yeah. What about you, Sherrod? Do you journal?
Only when I travel. And because I tried the daily diary, you know, thing, you know, dear diary, that kind of thing. And I found it I did this when I was a teenager, by the way. And I didn't find
it. No, a teenager doesn't count. What about now?
Now... No, but I do take notes when I go traveling. But you know, the thing is, my relationship to writing has changed, partly because I've become a, you know, when I turned into a journalist, then I was kind of constantly documenting. But my approach wasn't a personal one. I wasn't writing a diary to myself. I mean, in some sense, all my work is...
Your memoirs, were you?
I wish I had.
I never really thought myself so important that I would write my memoirs.
Actually, talking about teenage, I wish I had the chance to retrieve what I wrote in my teenage life, but it's all lost.
Oh, I recently read my teenage diaries.
Did you cringe?
Yes. It was bad, guys.
Well, at least you have them and you can, you know, you go back and see yourself, right?
6:30 now. We've got Keith Kam standing by with news on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. 6:40 right now, Monday the 7th of November. This is The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan and Julian Ng. Now, that was Bad Company with Can't Get Enough. Now, if you can't get enough of news, but you don't have any time to read through all the news websites, the Daily Skim is something that you would probably interest you. It's an email newsletter featuring short, pithy summaries of the day's news. The writing is casual and it's meant to sound like the news is being delivered by a friend. So there's, I think 4 years after its launch, the Skim has over 4 million subscribers now. Sharad, you pointed this out. I'm not a subscriber of the Skim, but I have heard of the two founders who put this company, this email newsletter together. What are your thoughts on the Skim?
Well, you know, honestly, I'd only heard of it yesterday when I was watching television. And I was like, oh, you know, there's a service. But what intrigued me was the discussion around it, which had to do with millennials. And I think they mean, in this case, it was about American millennials and their habits and such. And, you know, and of course, a lot of the prejudice and stereotypes that go along with having these broad demographic categories that we ascribe certain characteristics to. So I don't know what the Malaysian millennial is as opposed to an American millennial. But the question is, shorter attention span, a lack of interest in, you know, current affairs, more kind of like self-directed or whatever. I mean, these are the many kinds of prejudices or, you know,
stereotypes
that might be of millennials. But to the extent that people consume news or anything, you know, differently and over time it changes, there's an evolving habits, right? I think that was interesting. So I was thinking, okay, you know, maybe I should try and subscribe to this, and then gonna have all kinds of problems with my, you know, my iPhone or Apple ID. So I never really got there. But
why did you find
this
interesting?
Well, I'm always interested in aggregators, partly because I think there is a premium placed on us being able to know everything. It's partly the hazard of the occupation of being a journalist. But I think just for ordinary people, the sense that, oh, there's just so much happening in the world, but you're on top of things, and, you know, and you're sold this idea that if you are to be truly sophisticated and a cosmopolitan, you really should have a view on everything that's happening around the world.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think to be a truly informed global citizen, you should be reading the news and not skimming the news. And this is where I have a problem with this. And I don't know whether this is because I'm a journalist or because I'm a news junkie, but there's something about the way this is written that feels like the idea is to be pithy and to be kind of casual, but it feels like it's dumbing down the news. Now, I'm just going to read the headline from the final presidential debate in Las Vegas. Trump and Hiltz had a night out in Vegas. So Hiltz, Hillary Clinton is the Hiltz, you know, because you need a catchy nickname to get, you know, people's attention. Is that necessary? And is that really the essence of news, to kind of blur the lines with entertaining someone?
I don't know if I share the same feeling as you about the importance of news, because I think the value added to news is how you're clever enough to read between the lines, right? Because I think that people who read too much news at the end of the day can dangerously get misinformed, because it's always framed in a certain way.
Too much,
right?
Information?
Yeah, and I don't know. I actually like the idea of just skimming the headlines, because you know that by just reading the headlines, you know where the direction of that news story is going to go. And I would rather actually spend more time being more detailed about my reading in the other stuff, like the classics, for example, which gives you the ability to actually see the world through the eyes and lenses of these very smart people. Well, right?
Okay. Marcel Proust.
Whoever I feel skimming headlines or trusting headlines, you're putting a whole lot of trust in news editors to accurately condense what the article is about. So if you just skim, say, the first paragraph or two, you may not get the essence of a badly written the news
I'm
on a badly written
article. I never trust anything.
Exactly. So if you just read the headlines, Jules, you may not get the real story.
But maybe the idea is, Melissa, not to assume that you're getting the real story. All you're getting is a sense of something. And you know, and I think Jules has the right attitude, which is, unless you really have the time and energy to drill down on some particular story, just assume that you have a sense of what is, that this is a story happening in the world, but it's not necessarily adequate. I mean, so, you know, it's a much more modest approach to what's happening. The skimming isn't about becoming an expert.
To be informed with what's happening.
It's not. I mean, the word informed also is kind of loaded, right? It suggests that you have all sides and is a balanced view and all that. And you don't get that from skimming. You just know it's a story. You know that, okay, today, you know, Hong Kong, there are protests. We know Turkey is cracking down in such a way that it might no longer be a democracy. And you know that, but you don't know the what's driving it. You don't know the motivations. You don't know who the actors are. All this can only happen when you drill down, right? And should you? I mean, Global Citizen, that's an extraordinary burden to place on ordinary people.
Exactly.
They can hardly be a citizen of their own country, never mind a global citizen.
My question is, right, talking about Global Citizen, I guess, why do you guys think that it's important to be abreast of current affairs? And why is that more important than, say, having a very narrow view in a special interest, for example? Some people might like music, some people might like chess, right? And out of the world of chess, this person who's really very smart does not care about current affairs. Do you think that current affairs deserve that special place in our attention and our day?
I understand that we can't care about everything because that will just, your mind would explode. So you can't care and champion every single cause in the world. But I do think it's important to take note of what's happening around the world.
Why is
if
that?
Not, then you would be too insular because the world is essentially borderless now. What happens in the US with the presidential elections will affect what happens here in Malaysia, what happens with China, what happens in Turkey. There could be repercussions here in Malaysia. Why shouldn't we find out about it?
I think Julian's question is very important, you know, because I often find myself in awe of those people who are up to their nostrils in something arcane like art history or business or, I mean, you know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, I was saying to Julian this morning, I watched an interview with Warren Buffett and I was thinking, you know, and some of the criticisms, because I started Googling him, his private life and all this kind of detractors, what they say. They say, you know, he's so single-minded. He lives, breathes, sleeps business, right? And he's done extraordinarily well for it. But it's not like this man has no worldview. He does. He, you know, he talks about his, you know, experience in a particular community that, you know, project that served African Americans, and it opened himself up to ideas about what he wanted. So he's given away a huge amount of his own money, right? I mean, because it's not, you know, he didn't make the money to make money. He was not interested in buying more and more of the same stuff. So he has a worldview, but he's very focused. And I love people like that. Musicians. I love musicians who must spend most of their day not reading the news, but practicing and deepening their interpretation of their music.
What if everyone was like that?
I think it would be a better world.
Would we care about something that was not in our backyard?
But I don't think they're robbed of a worldview. They're just robbed of the details. They might not be able to sit down and talk about the Turkish situation. I mean, I think people, dilettantes like myself who skim the surface of everything are great at parties. But really, at the end of the day, what's going to be written on my tombstone? My epitaph is like, oh, he was a dilettante.
If there's smog in the air, you would smell it. You don't really really need a headline to tell you that, right? And then you know something is not right about the world. Whether you want to read about it in more detail or continue with your music, violin in a less smoggy area, you know, that's a choice to be made.
So if we were to come back to the Daily Skim, this email newsletter we were talking about, and the fact that it was initially made targeted for millennial women. So both of you are, pardon me, but no longer millennials.
No longer women.
No longer in that category of millennials. So you're saying that, you know, this is more than just millennials. Non-millennials also, baby boomers or people older would want a skim newsletter.
It doesn't. It depends on your attitude towards you know, things like the news. But
so everyone has a shorter kind of attention span when it comes to news.
Yeah, I think so. I not just news, shorter attention span
so
to
what
anything.
Changed, Sharad? Because
you're constantly distracted. Like we were complaining just now about people constantly being on their devices or taking photographs, and everything becomes.
Were you
mediated.
Like that before? Before you had an option of condensed news aggregator, did you read an article from start to finish?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the time before Google. I went to university, you know, before there was... I read books, you know, and
so
I read cover to cover.
Why now do you want a shortened version?
I struggle to read books. I struggle to read long-form essays. I'm suddenly in the middle of a fascinating piece about Greenland and, you know, the melting glaciers.
Oh,
there.
My God.
You know, and it's going to... And I'm still halfway through it, you know. But, the world changed.
Okay. Well, 6:50 right now. Tell us what you think, whether you would enjoy a shortened news aggregator or you read an article from start to finish. Hashtag TellBFM. Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. 6:51 coming up in about 10 minutes. We've got the news. But first, Tracks of My Tears by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.